I with God, Vashenka adds in his voice of thunder that shakes the ground beneath their feet. He asked for help for another, not for himself. We all heard him. When the young fighter walked into the Lemurian sea and prayed for help, to help his partner, to help your favorite Avatar and Lil, an act of love in war. Any of us could have answered. You didn't, so I did. And do. Surely we agree. From that one selfless act all this has sprung. To right a balance still upset. That mortal fighter begged you for the life of his partner and then for his own life. And you had mercy. Mercy is not in favor in my heavens today, says Vashenka, unforgiving and combative, folding vast arms and spearing harmony with lightning that crackles from his gaze. Nor in mine, Enlil agrees, adding thunder of his own. The goddess of love in war entangles their aggression in her hair, as long as infinity, ensnares it, holds it till it fades away. Balance drives all things through all things, harmony reminds them. You upset the balance, Vashenka, and died of it yourself, and lost adherency and loyalty and the love of souls. Now reborn, you start anew. Beware the same cycle overcoming you again. Spend souls profligately and they'll not love you. Then what have you? Empty altars, empty temples, empty threats of power you no longer wield. Vashenka's lightning forks to earth and thunder rolls once more. Harmony waves her hand and thunder ceases. Black clouds split and sunshine bathes the fields across the whole of heaven. The god Enlil says, Vashenka, you lost Tempest thus. Your greatest earthly avatar, and now he is mine. I have raised him up far beyond what you ever did for any man. The goddess is correct in that. And look what comes of all this, Vashenka rumbles, calling back his thunderheads around him like a cloak. We three are disunited in the face of angry fates and killing mist, fighting among ourselves over frail mortals when we should be fighting greater dooms and malignant powers not subject to the rules that men or gods obey. You have nothing to fight a war and win with, Vashenka, declares Enlil, shaking out his yarrow honey hair to tangle up with harmonies and to blow across his high brow free from lines. You have no true believers among the fated dead, and no souls who love you, no empire raising up your standard when it fights, no armies going down to you on bended knee. You are a puny god, ignoble and cowardly, all but forgotten. The missing god, they called you once, these mortals. Was that missing in action or missing in heart? Harmony is right. It takes love to war. It takes passion to fight. And you have no love. No passion beyond your own passion for yourself. When you have an avatar, come back and walk with us again, Enlil decrees and ends the summit unresolved with a flash of lightning that blows all knowingness away, and gods away, and time away. with no pact made by these three against greater enemies of men and gods. So Theomachy still reigns in heaven, until another day, when a better balance may come to be and men and gods unite. Lysis couldn't help teasing Chorus, nobody could. When Chorus walked by Sink to get his mount, Sink called out, "Look, Chorus, it's easy, just like riding a horse." Rotating his hips, fists out, grasping the air. Stepson's cat called and Thebans broke out laughing until they cried and staggered, hugging one another. Charon wanted Lysis to stay away from Chorus, whose black rage was evident and mounting, but that was impossible. They were teamed for duty with Artem. Then Critias came out to the barracks, his fine Cyrese face determinedly impassive, and said, "The Riddler thinks you need to have a lesson, Chorus. This ritual involves a chariot. Sink, get it ready. You're going to teach him." And nobody could be pried away from the training field for that lesson. By the time Sink and brown-haired, brown-skinned Gorgias brought out a training chariot, rolling it with no horses, lifting it by the center pole, everyone was gathered there but the new mercenaries, who didn't quite dare walk away from their appointed tasks. Gorgias, his smashed countenance betraying no amusement, straddled the chariot's center pole. Sink beside him said, "We need a volunteer." This flat statement started everyone up again, elbowing one another and waxing scatological. "Volunteer for what?" Perseus, the young curly-haired poet, called out.
"You just did. You're going to be the girl. Get in here,"
Sink decreed. Nearly 20 men around the rail howled gleefully.
"You too, Chorus. The Riddler wants you trained on this. Just think of it as a tutorial on tactics, techniques, and procedures."
Suggestions rang out. Simmias, Percy's gray-haired partner, sidled up next to Charon, perhaps the only man who wasn't laughing, and said,
"What's the drill?"
"Deadpan."
By now Chorus was out there in the middle of the training field, stiff-legged, red as a beet, and men were clapping and sounding long, plaintive wolf calls while Gorgias and Sink strung ropes from the chariot's rails through the rings of the car's floor and back to the front of its rim, where the center pole attached. Then curly-haired Perseus bent his dark head to Sink's. Sink whispered in his ear. Chorus glowered. Gorgias put one foot on the center pole to keep it down. Sink led Perseus by the uplifted hand like a bride around to the back of the chariot's car and handed him up into it. Perseus grabbed one rope in each hand and hopped up, backwards, onto the chariot's forward rim, saying, "Come on, big guy, let's see what you've got," wriggling his buttocks suggestively. Perseus leaned back against the ropes, dropped his butt further over the car, and made a kissing noise. Even Charon was laughing now. Chorus bolted, running through the gate, toward the stables. Perseus, linen-covered buttocks hanging provocatively over the chariot's rim, peered over his shoulder at Gorgias and asked, "Was it something I said?"
"Go after him, Lysis," Charon decreed. "Stay with him and don't laugh at him." Lysis found Chorus saddling up the roan. You'd better go back out there. They don't mean anything by it. The Riddler wants, and then a shadow darkened the stable doorway. Tempest stalked in and said to Lysis, You, outside. Critias was right behind the commander, as Lysis hurried to obey, Critias said.
Everyone's going back to his duties. You too, Lysis, whatever you were scheduled for, get about it.
Lysis had never heard that tone from Critias, but he was scheduled to ride with Chorus into Sanctuary. Lysis stopped in the stable doorway, uncertain, faced with conflicting orders. So he heard Tempest's gravelly voice saying to Chorus, They're trying to help you. You wouldn't want to face that chariot for the first time in the palace.
You're a warfighter. How did you think the god of sack and pillage would take a maiden? In a bower of flowers with garlands all around? This is a different kind of battle, but battle it is. Get out there and plan your strategy, your tactics. There's more than one way to accomplish this mission. From inside the car or outside, think it through, son of the storm god. Don't leave everything to Vashanka, or your life will be hell.
Then the Riddler brushed by Lysis, long eyes flashing with displeasure, and stopped.
You, Theban,
Tempest said to Lysis.
You're Karen, son. The one who got the dart tube from stealth and wouldn't give it up?
I am, Commander.
And you ride with Chorus?
I do, sir.
Then get your horse ready, and his, and find that other boy, the seer. Once Critias and I give Chorus his lesson, we're going to Phoebe's to get the bloom off you three roses before you wilt in public.
Tempest strode away. Critias came over to him, glaring before Lysis could digest the shock of being singled out by the commander. Tempest still remembered Lysis from the fracas over the dart tube. Lysis wished he'd never seen that tube, or blown a dart at Sham, or tried to keep the tube when Randall came for it. Some said the commander had the dart tube now. Critias growled at him.
Why are you standing around? Get hot. You heard the commander. Saddle up and soldier up for this. If you think sacred band honor isn't at stake next Ilsdi, you're wrong.
Lysis was struck dumb and numb, but he had his orders. So he got Artan, and they went into the stable to get the three horses ready. When they came out, it was as quiet in the barracks as any grave, as deserted as a pyre when the flames have burned down. And when they rode out, the Riddler was in the lead with stealth on their magnificent dapple-gray troce horses. Critias, all prickly and stern, was riding beside Lysis, with Chorus and Artan bringing up the rear. Out at the training field there was not one stepson. No one from the Theban sacred band was in evidence, except for Lysis's father, who waved at him and signed a blessing as he rode past. But the training chariot still sat there, balanced on its two wheels and the tip of its center pole, in the middle of the bullpen, ropes dangling over its rim. Lysis had heard about Phoebe's Inn and what went on there. It was the smallest and most esoteric of the brothels on the Street of Red Lanterns. None of the young Thebans had ever been there. Older stepsons dropped their voices low when they talked about it, if the boys were near. Lysis wished he was riding with someone other than Critias, Tempest's executive officer.
"You're the blessed one. The Theban who's supposed to have some goddess-given gift with horses?"
Crit asked him.
Show me.
From then on, Critias critiqued Lysis's horsemanship, correcting everything Lysis did the whole long way into the city. At Phoebe's, Lysis and Artan were left to take the horses to the stable nook before going inside. Artan said, "I don't want to go into the brothel." Lysis said, "You'll be fine. Just leading the Tros horses was enough challenge for one day." The big stallions had sized up Lysis and Artan and decided that horses, not stepsons, were in charge. When they finally got all six horses safely inside the stable nook, Artan came up close.
"Something awful's going to happen."
"Stop saying that. Nothing ever does," said Lysis, but his skin crawled. It was whispered that something terrible had happened the night Artan had predicted it, but no one knew just what. Something about Nicodemus and the goddess and the mage guild. Nevertheless, stealth seemed fine, although he'd cut off nearly all his hair. "You know, Artan, Theban set great store by prophecy. You need to tell me more. What do you see?" They left the dark stable nook and went around to Phoebe's front door. At least it wasn't raining. It hadn't rained for 2 days straight, but clouds were massing again.
"First off, there's going to be an awful storm."
Artan craned his neck at the late afternoon sky where a wall cloud was coming in off the sea.
"Chorus is furious."
"Something better than that," said Lysis.
"Just make sure you have your weapons ready," Artan said.
"Can't you be more specific?" Lysis always had his weapons ready. He was a Theban sacred bander.
"I hate to jinx us."
"I'll take that chance."
"It'll be like the battle plane at Chironea, just as bad. So many men, so many dying."
"Today? There's no room here. No battle plane."
"Not today. Today, just you watch out. We needed to make sure the horses are all secure in the stable. Something's going to happen here. You'll want to keep your ears and eyes open. You're going to distinguish yourself, or die trying. So be very careful."
"In a whorehouse, with the senior staff here? I don't think so." And then they went up the steps and inside, where a fat woman daubed with too much paint and powder leered at them as if she were a man and they were the harlots, and Lysis forgot all about Artan's reluctant prophecy. If Artan had been a Theban, maybe he would have been easier to credit. Artan was clearly frightened of this mannish woman covered with paint. Lysis puffed up tall. The senior staff and chorus weren't anywhere in sight. Half a dozen girls lurked there, posturing suggestively. The bordello mistress said, "You're lucky young men's stepsons. Critias picked out your girls for you personally. Now just come with me." Thereupon the two sacred banders were led by Madame Phoebe herself, their guide on this descent into whoredom, to two waiting strumpets who were giggling and took them each by the hand. Artan was dragged off, looking backward at him helplessly, by a black-haired beauty in sparkling blue veils. Lysis's companion suited him better, willowy and soft-eyed, all in grey linen as if she were a priestess, with long brown hair falling to her waist. "I promise, Lysis, this isn't going to hurt a bit," she said, and led him up the stairs. It wasn't even dark outside yet. Thus it wasn't dark in his tart's room. He was shy, but she was slow and engaging. He noticed the ropes on her bedstead and other things that gave him pause. A lash whip, some chains, and a strange low amphora, upended on its mouth with its point up in the air. But there was a big bed there, with silky covers. She led him to it.
"What's all this?"
he asked, motioning around still in his armor. "Not for you," said the girl, putting her hands on his cuirass, on the pin of his chlamys. "You're going to be fine. Let's take all this off." He didn't want to see her, didn't want her to see him. He wished it was dark. "Close the curtains," he said. Then he was glad she didn't when his head started to spin as she stripped off his armor and pushed him down on the bed and wrapped herself around him before he had time to pull off his tunic. Her legs were around his waist when he heard a stallion scream from the stables. He knew that sound. He scrambled off her, grabbing his gear while she fussed at him. He'd never dressed so fast. He was running down the stairs, buckling his sword belt as he went, careening out the door. Around the back, he got there just in time to see the commander's big troth stallion on its hind legs. Someone with a drawn sword was brandishing that blade at the horse's soft underbelly. Lysis yells, drawing his own short sword, running as fast as he can. The man with the stallion's reins in one hand and a sword in the other looks around, sees him, and lets go of the horse, retreating. The stallion, furious, stalks forward on its hind legs. Lysis could see some blood against the gray hide, but the horse wasn't giving any ground. "Easy, big horse, easy." The troth just keeps on coming, retribution in its fiery eyes. The man with the short sword hesitates and then makes a choice. He runs toward Lysis, away from the horse, who's gotten one foreleg tangled in its rein. The stallion is pulling on its own bit and fighting to get its head free, but still coming on, ears flattened. Lysis holds his ground, calling out, "Come on, coward! Come fight me, not a helpless animal!" But the big dappled stud isn't helpless. The horse is down on four legs and preparing to charge, pawing the ground. Beside the stable nook, there's a fence, an alley, a jumble of trash. The troth horse breaks its bridle. First the brow band hangs from one ear, then the leather and the bit fall away and are gone under the horse's legs. The man, sheathing his sword, takes one more look at Lysis and runs up the trash heap to vault over the fence. The horse leaps forward. Lysis must make a choice, either chase the would-be horse thief or try to keep the stallion from bolting up the alley onto the street of red lanterns. He chooses the horse, even though, enraged, it's still coming on, ears flattened, jaws agape, roaring and squealing. Lysis sheathes his short sword. Its rasp is very loud as it settles in its scabbard. Spreading his arms wide, he starts walking toward the horse, knowing it is going to run him down. Seeing the glowing oblong pupils in those hard, wild eyes. These troth horses are trained to kill, and Lysis is the only obstacle between the stallion and the way home. The stallion wears no bridle to grab, but Lysis knows exactly what he must do. He must stop the troth horse. He can't let Tempest's horse get loose, run off down the street. He is the Blessed One, whom Harmony has given an affinity for horses. He will stop this horse or die trying. The world slows down. every stride of the oncoming stallion takes an eternity. Hoofbeats pound, snorts and neighs sound too loud. Clarion calls blare as the runaway horse bears down on him. Just before it tramples him, he thinks, "Oh, Harmony, you blessed me, gave me skill with horses. If I still have it, please let it save me now. Otherwise, oh, Harmony, beloved goddess, please take my soul, because that horse is going to kill me and run on, and I'm not going to try to stop it with a sword." A blurry shape moves up beside him and past, so fast he's not sure if it's a man. Now that shape is in front of him. The gray stops in its tracks. Raising its frothing muzzle, it screams a challenge to the clouds. Its ears flick forward, back, forward again. Lysis's commander stands in front of him, stripped to the waist. The Riddler says, "He won't hurt you, Lysis. Not with me here. Go on by me and get me a rope or a halter or a strap from the stable." Without thought, Lysis unbuckles his sword belt and strips the gear from it, sliding everything through his hands, letting his gear drop to the dirt. "Here, take this," he says. His commander takes Lysis's belt and walks up to the infuriated Tros, talking to it very low. The horse takes a step toward the Riddler. The Riddler takes a step toward his horse. The stallion lowers its head and puts its face against the half-naked man's chest. Tempest fastens the strap around the stallion's neck. There isn't much leather to grasp, but there's enough. Then Tempest runs his hand down the horse's chest. His fingers come away, smeared with blood. Lysis walks carefully, slowly, up to the commander and his horse.
"What else can I do?"
"Just stay behind me. We're going to walk him in there and get him cleaned up. He won't die from that wound unless it's poisoned." In they went, Lysis still with his arms spread wide, following the dappled rump of the Tros, who left little drops of blood behind as he walked calmly beside his master into the stable nook. Not until they had gotten some hot water and cloths and dressed the shallow sword cut on the stallion's lower chest did Lysis remember his gear and his weapons were lying in the dirt outside. By then Critias was there, holding everything that should have been strung on Lysis's sword belt. And Artan was there, staring around.
"I told you," Artan said.
Critias squeezed Lysis's shoulder, saying, "Nice, stepson, really nice," and actually grinned at him as he handed Lysis his sword and scabbard, his belt pouch and his dirk. "Now describe him, the fellow you chased off." Then Lysis really understood that he'd saved the horse, and he began to realize how much that act meant to the senior stepsons. He told Critias everything he remembered, and then he repeated for Stratton everything he'd said to Critias. Critias and Stratton wanted to know if it could have been Shamshi, but Lysis wasn't sure. The swordsman was big enough, tall enough, young enough to make the vault over the fence, but it might have been anyone. It all happened so fast. And the thief, or would-be horse murderer, was dark, as Shamshi had been on the beach, before which time Shamshi had been fair. So Lysis couldn't say for certain. Still, Critias and Stratton were pleased with him. All the tension over the dart tube he'd refused to give to Randall seemed to melt away, as if it had never been there. He wished he could say for certain whether the would-be horse thief had been Sham. They wanted him to say so. But he was the Blessed One, Harmony's chosen, and he wouldn't lie or fabricate. especially now when finally the awkwardness over the dart tube that stealth had given him and Randall had taken back seemed to be behind him. Despite the fact that Lysis couldn't say whom he saw at the stable, nor Critias and Stratton shimmied over the wall to take a look, coming back empty-handed with clenched teeth and muttered curses that the stallion's assailant had gotten away. As they stood around watching the horse, tending it, hoping it wouldn't die from poison or tie up from stress, Tempest came over to Lysis. By then it was storming outside again, lightning flashing and thunder boxing your ears. Only Corus was still enjoying the brothel's amenities. Artan was standing quietly in the doorway of the stable nook, looking up at the sky. The Riddler said, "That's the best horse I've got. You have done me a great service, Lysis. You deserve a reward. Name it." Until then, Lysis had been sure that the Riddler still disapproved of him. Lysis was the fool who had made Randall take the dispute over the dart tube all the way up to stealth in his sickbed. And, as the goddess had willed, to the commander himself. "I want a colt by that dappled stud." But they would never give him one. He was merely a Theban. The senior stallions get were too highly prized. Many stepsons coveted one and still had none. Stealth's wonderful black colt was one of the few. "No, they won't give me a colt." Then he knew what he wanted, if they'd let him have it. "I'd like to be paired, sir, with Artan here." He couldn't believe he'd had the courage to say it. If Tempest granted his request, Lysis would be the left-side leader of the first Theban stepson pairing ever. His father would be very pleased. He wasn't even sure he liked Artan, but Artan had been right. His foresight, his seer's gift, was real. Lysis was a Theban who respected prophecy above all other gifts. And he needed to have a real partner, a partner who was not his father. Now the commander appraises him, and Lysis understands what the men mean when they talk about the gaze that weighs your soul. Tempest's long hooded eyes, so ancient and wise, stare at him and into him and all through him. And the commander slowly says, "You have my approval, if Artan will agree." "Artan," Tempest's hoarse voice rang out, sharp and clipped. Artan comes over to the commander, behind Tempest, by the big Trosis stall. Critias is all attention, arms akimbo. Stratton, next to him, whispers in Crit's ear. Critias nods at whatever Stratton says and smiles. "Commander," quavers Artan, craning his neck to look up into those disconcerting eyes.
"Will you pair with Lysis, shoulder to shoulder, to the death, with honor?" asks their commander.
Yes, I will. I mean, I can. I mean, of course I will. Be honored to."
"Then here, before my officers, I say it to you. Life to you, stepsons, and everlasting glory. May you be steadfast and loyal to one another, and to the numinous fraternity of the sacred band."
"Life to you, Commander," says Artan.
"And to you, Commander," says Lysis.
And it is done. Lysis is a left-side leader among stepsons. He has achieved this dignity on his own merit, and he has chosen a right-side partner that his Theban brothers will esteem, a seer. He is no longer only Charon's son, dragged along by happenstance and fortune into this strange and demanding land. Lysis knows he is worthy. He is Harmony's blessed one. And the Riddler's troth stallion knows it, too, for it whinnies and bugles and charges around its stall as horses will, when they know something important is afoot.
Why can't I kill him?
Tempus is beyond your scope. What you tried today was foolish. You're lucky you survived. He is protected. You will have your day.
I couldn't even kill the accursed horse.
The horse doesn't deserve to die. Learn what can and cannot be asked from destiny.
Why couldn't we kill Nicodemus at the gates?
We did.
I saw him riding through town with the Riddler and their stepsons.
Then, if you want him dead again, we will have to kill him again. It may be that, to kill him, you will need to risk your own death more directly. Do you want to kill him that much? Do you want to kill him as much as you want to live? Sham? Shamshi? Answer me.
I want to kill him very much. I want to kill them all. But so far so few of them have died, no matter what I try.
They are fighters. They are the stepsons. They are the sacred band of thieves. They are skilled. There are many. You are one. If you keep this up, reinforcements may be needed.
But you said they're among the fated dead.
They are. That doesn't mean it is your fate to kill them. Any or all of them. It means only that they have a destiny, that men are born to die. And die they do. Each man dies at his appointed time.
I didn't. You saved me.
That is another discussion in which life and death become relative terms.
I want to kill them. I must keep trying. It's what I live for. It's what got me through the sickness. After what they did to me, I must. It's what I dream.
Then you will keep trying until you or they are dead. We have been invited to a feast. Perhaps your dream will come true there. Perhaps not. If we choose to act there, we must plan to act successfully. It will not be easy, and the risk will be great.
I'm not afraid.
Then learn to be afraid. Learn when to fear, and how to fear, and how much to fear before you squander all you have left.
End of chapter 39. Chapter 40. Three God Knight.
Identify yourself,
demands the palace sentry sharply, a single pale youth in too much cloak and armor, nervous and uneasy. The sentry checks his slate and peers at Crit in the last heat of day, while a full moon shines down from a blue sky turning red over battlements, bristling with guards. 30 of the palace guard stand watch, above, behind, and all around, but this lone sentry can still make a crucial error. Let the wrong people in. Let the wrong ones out on this momentous night when Vashenka and his avatar will be welcomed to Sanctuary officially.
What are your names?
Critias, the Riddler's executive officer, we're the band,
Crit replies, looking for a glimmer of recognition or relief on the sentry's worried face, now that the stepsons, armed and ready, are here in force, and doesn't find it. The palace is another world, the sentry's world, his to guard, his to save, his the blame if something goes wrong. Sunset sparkles off the helm and hilt of this anxious sentinel, guardian of the gate of the gods. Of the sacred band's 74, Crit has brought 50 along with him, and Strat, hardened fighters, uniformed in dark green linen and light wool chlamys, bronze and leather and iron girded on, ready for whatever comes their way. This checkpoint is miserably understaffed and unprepared for so many armed stepsons in a group. The sentry looks left, then right, craning his neck at all the formed-up sacred band, watching patiently. Hounds of hell before the hunt, waiting only for Crit's command to spring, and making no secret of their readiness with their promissory stares.
But who's here from the sacred band? I have to have the names.
The sentry taps his stylus on his slate. Or you don't get in. Better you'd have thought that through before, young soldier. Because this palace guard will need some help if every name is not on that list.
Walgrin should have taken care of this. Listen closely, then, one time through.
Crit doesn't like this sentry who's too defensive, too intimidated. Flustered men make errors, sometimes deadly ones. And Crit doesn't like delays, not on any day, but especially not today. Behind him, his stepsons come to ready. Crit hears the smallest signs of patience wearing thin, clinks and rustles, terse whispers, shields shifting. Stratton nudges Crit with his hip.
Let's move.
26 sacred band pairs need to get through this gate and onto the grounds where their commander expects them to deploy. Their horses are already in the palace stables. Crit regrets the necessity of leaving mounts behind. Can't be helped. He knocks his own hip against Stratton's in return. Harder. Wait. The sacred band pairs are strangers all to the palace guard. Finesse is vital, here and now. Crit calls the roll in formation order.
Critias, Stratton, Sink, Gale, Cassander, Delius, Charon, Lysis, Arton, Perses, Simmias, Aegis, Arceus.
Crit stops. He coughs and spits too near the sentry's feet. Harry should have been here. And his partner, Dion. But they weren't. Casualties of this war that wasn't won. Absent friends, up in heaven with Abarsis. He spat again, nearer the sentry's sandaled foot this time. Sometimes you had to make a statement. Sometimes words weren't enough. To his credit, this sentry didn't jump back or threaten or curse, so Crit continued calling out his men by name.
Dolan, Memor, Menander, Periander, Gorgias, Siren,
Simon of Athens,
Simon of Thebes,
Epony,
Zetos,
and on through all his stalwarts, his stepsons, his Thebans, and the new mercenaries Tempus had so recently hired, until 52 names were recited for the record. And the sentry checked them off, each and every one. Of the 52 of them facing this young sentry, better than half were Thebans, the fated dead, whose brother's bones lay under a granite lion, a world away.
Sentry, we have senior officers waiting inside. We have orders. If trouble starts, you'll be glad we're here.
Crit's patience, never great, was coming quickly to an end.
Now let us pass, before my Commander Tempest wonders why we're late.
Crit has said the magic word. Call that name, and every gate opens wide. The sentry closes his slate, gives way with an exaggerated bow, and the sacred band files by, not asked to give up their weapons. This sentry has been forewarned, then, by Walgren, by Torchholder, or the palace prefect, because no stepson was relinquishing weapons tonight, not with Shamshi on the prowl, picking them off like festival prizes at a charity booth. Not with Ascalon abroad, an otherworldly threat. Onto the grounds the sacred band flows, smooth as water, perfectly rehearsed, and spreading out among the throng, each to his assigned position, casual as you please. Even so, obvious doesn't half cover it. So be it. The sacred band has a job to do. Maintain order where chaos is intrinsic. Not easy. Two storm guards will be here tonight. Enlil is always with Tempest. Vashanka will claim Kurus this night, inhabit their young stepson. Take back what is his, or some of it. Critias has been happy enough without Vashanka calling shots or setting battle tempo. Tempest was terrible in his wrath and temper when Vashanka was his patron god. Enlil is harsh, but just. Better. Fairer. More apt for fighters in a sacred band. Enlil, storm god of the armies, is a cannier war god than Vashanka to Critias' way of thinking. Always subtle, never crude. And Tempest had said darkly, giving Crit his orders, "We'll see the gods tonight, Critias. And a goddess, I'll bet. See how heaven battles for the loyalty of men. And see the Lord of Dream and Shadow. So watch where you step, lest you step into something that sticks to your feet." So had Enlil told Tempest something, warned him, or was it only the black humor of his immortalized commander, twisting Crit's soul up with worries half understood? Or plain truth that Critias, just a soldier, couldn't understand? Whatever Tempest meant, the band was here with complex orders. Whom to watch, whom to guard, how and when, what to guard against, when to show your blade. Whatever Tempest thought was in store this evening, watching Kurus prove his manhood wasn't the whole of it. But with Stratton on his right and his contingent deployed in perfect order, Crit felt ready for anything. Now to keep things that way, that's the trick, the test, the task, when gods are invited out to play. Next, Tempest comes up to them, parting the crowd with Nico on his right. The commander is wearing stepson issue. No leopard skin and boar's tooth tonight. Stealth, too, wears summer armor, no dream-forged panoply. Nico has been strange these last days, reticent, looking out from under hacked-off hair, brooding. Yet Stealth is strong and fit this evening, moving with unconscious grace, effortlessly poised like some fighting noble who'd never languished at death's door. Not so thin, not with burning eyes sunk deep, but with enough muscle gliding over bone to win a fight. Here tonight Nico is all business. He squeezes first Strat's shoulder, then Crit's. "Good you're here, Ace. Fox, no trouble at the gates? Or in the stables?"
"None," Crit says.
war names this evening from Nico. That choice speaks volumes. Stealth looks past Crit at everyone, everywhere, looking for something. Looking for someone in the throng. It's hard to pick out individuals in the courtyard. Too many people crowd the celebration on the lawn. Oligarchs in riotous brocade and priests in claret velvet and lace. Women with copper beads weighing down multicolored skirts and veils that veil nothing, clutched to upthrust breasts. Diners queued up at festival boards laden with crusty lambs and glossy pigs with open mouths. Musicians playing flutes and lyres, drums and bells, horns and harps, powdered whore mistresses and demure noble women. Tattooed sailors and decorated soldiers, corpulent and sepulchral, ascetic and indulgent, dark and fair, short and tall, all are here tonight. Nico fixes Crit with a penetrating stare. Call if you need us. Unnecessary and bold for Nico to speak so with Tempest by his side. The Riddler doesn't say a word. There's no need. You can feel the guard residing in their commander this evening. Stronger the closer you get to him. And Tempest, like Nico, looks askance at everyone and everything, Crit included. Is the guard talking to him now, whispering in his skull, peering through those ancient eyes? A chill walks over Critias's skin. He rubs his arms. At last, the Riddler inclines his head to Crit and says, Fox, watch the boy tonight, Corus, very closely. Ride back to the barracks with him. He doesn't stay here, no matter what. Send Lysis and Artin to us when you don't need them. Clear?
Perfectly clear, Commander.
Though it wasn't. Not why or how. Above the walls, sunset flares incendiary. Palace guards light torches here and there and everywhere. If you see Ascalon or Shamshi, bring us to them, the Riddler orders. And he and Stealth stride away, larger than life. A pair of heroes stepped off some marble temple wall. Stealth gets more like the Riddler every day. Tempest says over his shoulder, For the rest, you know what to do. This time, Crit hopes he does. What is he expecting? And Strat says, The Riddler still has that dart tube, you know. For no reason, Crit can fathom. Except that Ishard is whispering in Strat's ear too much lately. If Strat hadn't been his partner for so long with the necromant in his blood again, despite all Critias had tried to do to keep them apart, Crit would be wondering if he could trust Strat, should push come to shove here. And on this night of all nights, Critias needed to be able to trust his partner implicitly. Now Jihan comes swaggering up, scattering the crowd effortlessly, wearing a long skirt under her scale armor, hair and eyes and skin gleaming like molten copper. The skirt seems somehow out of place with greaves and armor, but Jihan makes her own rules. Stormbringer, father of all the weather gods, had sent her to Tempest to learn humanity. She cuts a swath through lesser women and wistful men, destroying beyond redemption any attempt by Critias and Stratton at anonymity. Crit! Stratton, she says, too loudly. In that voice like waves crashing on a beach, Life to you and everlasting glory! So they return the sacred band greeting. All around, people gawk at the glimmering woman with the impossibly beautiful body. At her tiny waist, her high rump, her pert breasts and muscular limbs. Jihan, Crit whispers.
People are staring at you.
Yes, the skirt. I shouldn't have worn it. It keeps sticking between my legs when I walk.
She reached behind her rump and pulled at the fabric.
Isn't it fascinating? About Nico and the goddess? Where are they? Does he look different? Can you tell?
Crit is dumbstruck.
What?
Stratton says,
Tell what, Gian?
What's fascinating?
Crit says, Never mind. Merlin's coming. Don't talk about it, whatever it is.
Randall is back,
Gian says under her breath as she sidesteps Molin's hand about to slide around her waist from behind.
Look, Karen, do you see the Riddler's wind charmer, Gian, over there, dressed like Athena, fitted up for war?
Gorgias muttered.
Why do you imagine is such a dangerous creature among us if this is merely a social gathering?
Gorgias was followed closely by Aegis and Archias, shoulder to shoulder. The Theban fighters gaped, speechless, at the best of sanctuary.
Arrayed in the torchlight on the palace courtyard's extensive lawn, a moist breeze blew, promising wild weather to come, fluttering the torchlight and casting it hither and yon. Since the young sacred band pair was near enough to overhear, Karen responded to Gorgias in an undertone.
"Because, Gorgias, Gian is the commander's...
what? Plaything? Mistress?
Friend and companion."
Gorgias was among Karen's most suspicious fighters, and many other Thebans were leery of Gian, daughter of an unbegotten. In Thebes, the powers of wind charmers had been greatly feared.
This Gian fights at the commander's side, therefore at our side. Rest easy, Gorgias. She's no menace to us, and ours but a potent force against adversaries of the sacred band. Can it be, old friend, that you want too much to live these days?
No, but I might want too much to die in this strange place where nothing is as it seems, and an honorable death may be elusive.
The night breeze stirred Gorgias's hair.
Tell me, Karen, why do you think this sacred band of stepsons needs so much help? And against what echelon of adversaries?
Musicians played softly somewhere, lilting melodies, chromatic and plaintive with semitones as if chosen by a knowing ear to ease all hearts. But not Gorgias's.
At the barracks, some Thebans hide when the wind charmer shows her face or brings her icy storms. And these stepsons have more unnatural allies than just the Froth Daughter. Witches, and worse, changing to birds and dogs. Men who need such friends face daunting enemies. Meanwhile, we Thebans have no oracle to guide us. Only this Riddler decreeing all. Unopposed.
Gorgias stomped determinedly through the celebrants with Archias and Aegis trailing behind. Karen must keep up or let these accusations go unanswered.
Gorgias, we owe these stepsons our lives. They are audacious, but that audacity saved every one of us.
Many Thebans were uneasy, living cheek by jowl with the supernatural and the inexplicable. Hard-faced Gorgias is always the naysayer, the voice of dissent in any council. There is no formal Theban council here. Inevitably, the sacred band pair, tagging along behind Gorgias, will repeat this conversation to all the others. Karen must win this point, nip dissonance in the bud to preserve their loyalty, stave off death.